This is an ABC podcast.
Good morning and welcome to AM. I'm Kim Landers. The economic hurdles facing the new Albanese government are growing. The International Monetary Fund is warning the global economy could soon be teetering on the brink of recession. And Treasurer Jim Chalmers is expected to deliver more glum news when he delivers his economic update to Parliament tomorrow. Ahead of that, the latest cost of living figures will be out today, and annual inflation is tipped to reach a three-decade high of 6.2%. Reporter Annie Guest has been taking a look at how people are coping with the rising costs of everyday items.
In North Brisbane, this mum is pushing her toddler in a pram through a shopping centre.
This is Ned and he's 19 months.
Shy boy. What are you up to?
Just getting some groceries and some scripts.
She tries to save money by shopping at the discount pharmacy for the medicine and the discount department store for other essentials.
I do, especially for the kid, all of his shopping, you know.
Nappies too?
Yes, nappies. You can buy the wipes packets in bulk.
However, rising prices are hard to escape.
Definitely, just recently looking at our credit card statement, it was like, oh, how did we spend $1,000 at Woolworths? But, you know, you can't not buy it, so we just have to cut back as much as we can on things.
But the part-time worker feels lucky compared to people worse off. And Edwina McDonald from the Australian Council of Social Service says there's a lot of Australians struggling to get by.
We've already got about 3 million people who are living in poverty, and they're just absolutely being crushed by the soaring costs that are following rising rates of inflation.
The acting CEO of ACOS is bracing for more bad news when the Bureau of Statistics releases the June quarter inflation figures today.
Yes, we'll be watching the figures as they come out today. We've obviously seen predictions that there'll be a significant rise, and we know that that's just going to have a devastating impact on the lives of people who are on fixed and low incomes.
Ms McDonald says many poorer Australians are already telling the Council of Social Service they're desperate.
People were already suffering before these price rises, and they're now being pushed further into destitution. We've just surveyed people who are on income support, and they're telling us that more than half of them are skipping meals or eating less, and almost everyone who regularly has been using a car is using their car less or not at all now.
She says the demand on food charities has increased 50% since the pandemic began, with one charity now helping to feed more than 1 million people every month.
We're hearing that people are just less able to be able to afford healthy food, fruit and vegetables and meat. And that's certainly something that's coming through and is a difference now between what people were able to afford when they had the higher coronavirus payments in the early stages of the pandemic.
What do you think that governments should be doing about this?
We know that the best solution to be addressing the cost of living increases is to lift incomes and to improve access to housing and essential services for those with the least. Many of them are on atrociously low $46 a day job seeker payments.
The federal government has already ruled out an increase to job seeker payments.
Annie Guest reporting. The price of fuel is one of the few things that's going down at the moment. That's because global oil prices have been falling for the past 6 weeks, as John Daly reports.
Where are we off to next?
To Horton's, just around the corner here.
Courier driver Hank Leeson is doing his rounds in the Queensland city of Toowoomba. He drives up to 1,200 kilometres a week. Hank Leeson says the sight of falling fuel prices is a relief.
Oh, big difference, especially in your bank balance at the end of the week. You actually see the fuel prices have changed. It means better profit for me in the business, and for the other courier drivers too.
When you started the business a year and a half ago, did you expect to see prices rise so fast and so high?
No, I didn't. I've actually got friends in New Zealand, and their fuel prices are way higher than ours, and I used to laugh at them for their fuel prices, and now we're copping the same thing here.
Global oil prices have slumped just over 20% in the past 6 weeks due to growing market fears of economic recession. With a stronger Australian dollar, wholesale and retail fuel prices have followed. Mark McKenzie is the chief executive of the Australasian Convenience and Petroleum Marketers Association.
The best indicator is to actually look at the wholesale price, which has typically fallen by about 25% since the start of July.
Inflation data for the June quarter is being released today. Rising fuel costs were a significant contributor to the 2.1% jump in the consumer price index in the March quarter. Mark McKenzie says the recent falls will only really shift the dial on inflation figures for the September quarter.
We did get a drop as a result of the excise cut in the first month of March, but we did see it increase again in June. So on balance, I think you're probably going to see it have the same influence that it had in March. Typically, fuel makes about 6% of the CPI basket. So when you look at it, it's not huge. But because fuel prices are everywhere, everyone can see fuel prices on a daily basis, can see them moving up and down, they tend to have a fairly marked effect on consumer sentiment.
Economists call that inflation psychology. And when consumers just expect prices to keep rising, inflation is a lot harder to get under control. Angela Jackson is the lead economist at Impact Economics and Policy.
So look, obviously when we're, you know, filling up our tank at the station, we remember pretty clearly what we paid last time, and it flows through to our perceptions about price rises. So certainly as fuel prices come off and those prices drop, then the expectations around inflation may well also be impacted.
Though Mark McKenzie says continued falls in global oil prices aren't yet certain.
To be honest, it really is a coin toss at this stage. All we know is that they're going to be volatile in the period going forward.
Mark McKenzie from the Australasian Convenience and Petroleum Marketers Association. John Daly reporting. The Prime Minister's vowed he doesn't want to waste a day in government, and one of the first pieces of legislation in Parliament is Labor's pledge for more ambitious climate change action. While the 43% emissions reduction target by 2030 is expected to sail through the lower house, it'll be an early test for Anthony Albanese's negotiating skills with the Senate crossbench. From Canberra, here's political reporter Matthew Doran.
I give the call to the Honourable Member for Goldstein.
Hear, hear.
Thank you, Mr Speaker.
The green benches of the House of Representatives are taking on a greener focus.
Ending the climate wars requires courage and ambition beyond politics.
Melbourne MP Zoe Daniel, one of a league of new independent MPs, taking to their feet for the first time.
We have an opportunity in this Parliament to go forward and to go forward together.
And on day two of the 47th Parliament, it's somewhat fitting one of the first exercises in legislative sausage-making for Anthony Albanese's government is dealing with that very issue.
We're back around the table of taking action on climate change. We're out of the naughty corner.
The Prime Minister wants his commitment to cut greenhouse gas emissions by 43% by the year 2030 enshrined in legislation. That bill will lob into Parliament today.
We'll be supporting our policy.
Getting it through the lower house, easy enough, given Labor's majority. But in the Senate, the government needs the support of the Greens and at least one independent, likely to be new ACT Senator David Pocock. The Greens want the new government to agree to stop new coal and gas projects going ahead. That's a step too far for the Prime Minister.
That would have a devastating impact on our economy.
Anthony Albanese's government is making it clear in its negotiations that 43% will be the baseline for cutting emissions this decade, promising ambition will be part of its legislation presented to Parliament. But he argues the Greens' demand would cripple Australia's resources industry and have little impact on global efforts to reach net zero.
China has stopped the import of Australian coal. That doesn't mean there's less coal being burned in China.
The details of the legislation will become clearer once it's introduced to Parliament. Anita Furster is an associate professor specialising in climate law at Melbourne's Monash University.
It's a really important signalling to the international community that Australia is taking climate change seriously.
Anita Furster insists the legislation will need to ensure the government can be held accountable on whether it's meeting its targets, and any updating of those targets should also be governed by tight rules to ensure progress in cutting emissions doesn't actually go backwards.
The hope is that you'll put in place a system which, once the wheels get moving, really generates ambitious climate action.
Opposition leader Peter Dutton has made it clear he's not backing the bill, although moderate Liberals such as Tasmanian Bridget Archer may cross the floor to support it. And while Labor doesn't need the vote of lower house MPs such as Zoe Daniel, she hopes progress is being made.
I appreciate the good faith the government has demonstrated to date in making changes to improve the legislation. So far, so good.
2 days in, 3 years to go.
Matthew Doran. As Australia tries to stop the entry of foot and mouth disease, our live cattle exporters are already taking a hit. The rapid spread of the disease in Indonesia has prompted feedlots there to halt or reduce imports from Australia. Indonesia is Australia's most lucrative market for live cattle, earning around $500 million a year, but that's now in jeopardy. Indonesia correspondent Anne Barker reports.
In good times, feedlots like this one import hundreds of thousands of live cattle every year from Australia. The cattle are sold and slaughtered in feedlots across Indonesia and help feed a population of 270 million people. The pandemic has already hit the industry hard because widespread job losses from COVID have meant many families have less money to spend on meat. Now, feedlot owners are facing another threat, with foot and mouth disease spreading across the country. Johnny Liano from Indonesia's Cattle Industry Association says consumers are fearful of eating contaminated meat and catching the disease themselves, even though the risk of that is exceedingly rare. But the much higher risk of cattle being infected has led feedlot owners to drastically reduce or even halt their imports of live cattle altogether. Yeah. I received reports from our members. Some have cancelled their import contracts. Some no longer order cattle, and the number is quite high. In percentage, it's about 50% down from the imports we have in normal times, he says. Even one infected animal would be enough to shut an entire feedlot, causing a massive loss to the business. That hasn't happened yet, but owners are now too fearful to import cattle until their herds are fully immunised. Australia has already offered 1 million vaccines to help Indonesia immunise cattle, but they're not expected to arrive till next month. And until vaccinations kick in, Australian livestock exporters face weeks, if not months, of reduced demand.
Once you lose demand, the prices do reduce. I think what we are seeing is a bit of a softening in the cattle price.
Mark Harvey-Sutton is CEO of Australia's Live Export Council. Yeah,
this is a logistical challenge. In terms of making sure that feedlotters can vaccinate cattle and those sort of things. So it's not because there's a lack of demand. It's because getting the cattle and the risk, all those sort of things, is presenting challenges, which is seeing at lower volumes at the moment.
Indonesia has so far vaccinated almost 700,000 head of cattle, but with a national herd around 18 million, there's a long way to go. And it's small farmers who are given priority for vaccines, meaning feedlot owners have much longer to wait. And that in turn means Australian exporters will have to tough it out indefinitely or find new markets altogether. This is Anne Barker in Jakarta reporting for AM.
Well, China and Australia have taken the first steps to resetting the fractured relationship between the two countries. There's still no official sign that Beijing is going to lift trade sanctions. But some Aussie exporters are cautiously optimistic that the tariffs on goods including wine, cotton, coal and red meat could be dropped, as Victoria Pengelly reports.
It's picking time for cotton growers in Queensland's Central Highlands region. After good rain and high global prices, confidence amongst farmers like Nigel Burnett from Emerald is soaring.
It's in a really good place at the moment. So the price for our cotton has got up to that $900,000 a bar. But as well as that, we've had the breaking of the drought from 2 years ago. So we went from a crop that was about 600,000 bales of cotton, and this year we're looking at 5.5 million bales of cotton.
It's a major shift from 2 years ago, when Chinese mills were told to stop buying Australian cotton, effectively bringing all trade to an end.
I think the ban hasn't had the effect that people thought it would have. I guess the world supply and demand balance sheet for cotton has meant that the market has gone up anyway.
In 2020, commodities such as coal, beef, lobster and wine were slapped with trade restrictions or tariffs as high as 200%. While some exporters have refocused on other markets, not everyone has recovered.
China was our fourth largest market by volume. To take that out of the system is quite substantial.
Jim Caddy is a grape grower and chair of the Inland Wine Regions Alliance in South Australia. He says winemakers have struggled to offset the billion-dollar loss from China.
If you didn't have a contract this year, it was very difficult to sell red grapes. And I would say in the next vintage, 2023 vintage, it's only going to get worse.
With a change in federal government, some exporters are now quietly optimistic trade tensions between China and Australia could ease. Whispers are emerging that China is considering lifting its soft ban on Australian coal. But 2 years after the diplomatic spat with the Morrison government, analysts say it won't be as easy as kissing and making up.
We've managed very well with us in Australia's situation to maintain good trade while still arguing on a number of diplomatic fronts.
Professor John Rolfe is a resource economist with Central Queensland University. He says exporters aren't rushing to see China's business return.
I think there's a lot of interest in diversification, particularly in the case of with Russia, Ukraine. It's showing that an open global system is not as secure in the future as has been in the past.
10 meat processors across the country continue to be banned from sending red meat to China. In outback Queensland, cattle grazier Josh Phelps says despite the blockade, the industry has bounced back and he's hopeful the new government could lead to greener pastures.
They only make so much good dirt, my grandfather used to say, so I think we are in a very good position to feed the world, and we have an asset, I suppose, in agricultural land or prime agricultural land that needs to be utilised to the best of its ability.
Federal Trade Minister Don Farrell is yet to meet with his Chinese counterpart, but he's told the ABC an olive branch has been extended. In the meantime, the federal government is remaining tight-lipped on whether trade restrictions could lift in the near future.
Victoria Pengilly. In the outback town of Broken Hill in far west New South Wales, members of the First Nations community are finding new ways to make sure traditional knowledge is passed on to younger generations. And the key ingredients are books and illustrations, as Yusuf Saudi reports.
David Doyle's passion for native plants and bush medicine was ignited when he was a kid in Menindee. The Barkindji Imaliyangappa man learnt from his grandparents and elders and currently spends time each week teaching Aboriginal children about their culture and history. But now, he's part of putting that knowledge into a book.
Plant identification book aimed at basically high school kids, that nice and easy reading, and then we had the idea of having it uploaded to the Library for All, and then through Julie having it across a lot of different age ranges.
David Doyle is part of a project with Library for All called Our Yarning Bushtucker Stories. Library for All is an organisation which creates digital-first libraries for children to read in languages they can understand. The Bushtucker Stories aim to increase reading engagement, traditional food literacy, and producing culturally relatable content. This includes forms like e-books to hard copies.
It's important because it shows that we've used these plants for millennia, and that we can continue to use them. It doesn't necessarily have to be looked at as you can only use them traditionally, so I like to use them a lot more contemporarily.
Cultural advisor and Nunga woman Julie Owen is based in Broome, but has been travelling across Australia to help gather stories as part of Our Yarning. It's the first free digital library made by Aboriginal people for Aboriginal children.
What we learn as children, we take through us as adults, but also we learn experiences through those things and we learn to share it with our own families.
Dr. Owen says these stories are part of making young Indigenous people feel represented in literature.
Our books are called mirror books, so that the books the kids pick up to read, they can actually see their own lives reflected in the stories.
Cubby Cubby woman Kelly Ryan is the co-founder and director of the Seedling Group and specialises in intergenerational trauma and resilience for First Nations people.
And so it's a way of sharing that knowledge, it's a way of regenerating that knowledge and passing that knowledge on.
Kelly Ryan says it was a way to rebirth information for the wider community of Australia to understand and a step in decolonising practices.
Being able to see yourself in a book that is shared so you can actually have visibility, you're not othered, is incredibly important. It's really good for your identity, really good for your social and emotional well-being.
For David Doyle, telling stories can contribute to the resilience of Indigenous people.
For me, it's a continuation of culture. Aboriginal people have always adapted to any situation, whether it be environmental, colonisation. So we've always adapted to it. So it's just another way we can adapt and continue our culture.
Indigenous storyteller David Doyle, ending that report by Yusuf Saudi. And that is AM for today. Thanks for your company. I'm Kim Landers.
Hi, I'm Sam Hawley, host of the ABC News Daily podcast. When an Australian journalist was detained by the Taliban and forced to apologise for her stories, it highlighted the threats faced by reporters since coalition forces pulled out of Afghanistan almost a year ago. Today we speak to Lynn O'Donnell about her escape and the terror the Afghan people are facing. Look for the ABC News Daily podcast on the ABC Listen app.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.